Welcome to the Advisor Pack monthly session. You know, delivering truly comprehensive financial services at a level that's high enough to actually get the attention of your clients so that they increase the number of referrals that they introduce you to, well, that's not easy to deliver at that level, but you can do it. And together we're going to show you how. This is the Advisor Pack monthly session. I'm Mark Little, and we're going to respond to the questions that you've submitted today. So we have two questions that were submitted. One was a question having to do with, you know, what can I do to make sure that my clients never leave me, never fire me? We received a question from an advisor who I guess had just unfortunately been let go by a client. So we're going to talk today about becoming indispensable. It's worth unpacking this idea, and it goes to the heart of the issue. Secondly, we received a question from a member of the Advisor Pack monthly program, basically describing how their meetings were unremarkable and that their clients were obviously not getting that much out of the meeting content. So we are going to discuss, in response to your request, we're going to go through preparing for an extraordinary client meeting experience. So let's get started. We recommend that you become indispensable. Now, we're going to talk quite a bit about what that means over the time that we're going to work together. But for now, just contemplate that for a moment. Let's say every one of your ideal clients considered you indispensable. Well, that's a place that you want to be, because advisors that are indispensable, first of all, clients will never let go of an advisor that they deem indispensable. So if you have somebody in your life that you just can't do without, you're not only never going to let them go, you're going to worry about what you would do if something ever happened to the relationship. So you being indispensable puts you in a position in the client's life where they will never let you go. In addition to that, if you look in our industry, the advisors that make the highest compensation for the value that they provide to clients, these are the advisors who are indispensable. So becoming indispensable is not an easy task, and you're going to be thinking about this, and that's the call to action today, is to think, how can I become more indispensable to my clients? But I'm going to stimulate you with some thoughts regarding some things that you can do. But the point is, it's got to be a good business decision. Now, there's the issue of the time and effort it will take to go from where you are now to becoming indispensable to your clients. And it's an acknowledgement on your part and on the part of everyone on your team that this is a call to action, that if this is going to happen, it's going to require both time and effort on the part of everybody on your team to really think of what you can do to become indispensable and then to deliver on that. So let's admit up front, this is going to take some effort. And then the business decision part of it is, it's got to be a good cost-benefit analysis. So whatever it's going to cost you and your team by way of time, by way of resources, it's got to be something that allows you a big profit at the end. So this is a business that we're running, and let's just admit that everything has to be profitable. That being said, becoming indispensable is really the only good business decision. It is worth the effort. Clients don't leave advisors who are indispensable. Clients will pay higher compensation to an advisor who's indispensable, as we've said already. And as far as the appreciation factor, if you are deemed indispensable in the mind of a client, then you are at a high value in that client's mind, and that's where you need and want to be. And why is that? Because there are 493,000 financial advisors just in the U.S. alone. If you take into account Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, We're talking well over 500,000 financial advisors in the English-speaking world. All these financial advisors are anxious to meet your clients. They would love to approach your client and explain to your client how the value offering that they have is superior to yours. So being that there is such a competitive environment out there, the idea of making the effort to become indispensable to your clients in many ways could be described as the only good, valuable business model that you've got open to you. Put another way, you want to provide enough value to your clients that their view of you as being indispensable closes their mind, closes their ears to the approaches of other financial advisors who are very anxious to meet your clients. And you don't want a client having any interest in another financial advisor. So this is a good business decision for you. The question is, how do you become indispensable? Well, we're going to focus on one aspect of this. Over the years that we will work together, there are many layers to this onion that we call indispensability. But what we're going to talk about today is really the starting place. This is the foundation. And the word is oversight. Your role, focusing on the concept of oversight, is what will make you initially indispensable to your clients. Oversight is a funny word, but the thing you need to think about is that in the context of what we're doing for clients, oversight is the one thing that clients do not feel that they're able to release to their financial advisor. So you may be doing a very good job technically. You and your team may be providing tremendous amount of value to your clients. But when it comes to oversight, clients have this view, and we've got quite a bit of data on this. Clients have this view that it's their role to oversee what you're doing, that they need to understand what you're recommending, why you're recommending it. They need to basically play judge and jury when it comes to your expertise and the recommendations that you're making. Well, why is this? Why is it that the client feels this is their job? Well, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but I think the main thing to keep in mind here is that clients don't believe they have any other choice. We could talk about how our financial services industry has acculturated clients to thinking that they are responsible for their own oversight. We could blame the internet because with the access of so much information available to clients, it's very tempting for clients to attempt to oversee their financial advisors because they can hop online and look at investments and read about the financial markets and read opinions of others. But I think the most important thing in this discussion we're about to have is to realize that clients feel they have no other option, that there is no body out there that they could hire to oversee their financial affairs and to oversee the financial people in their lives and to oversee and provide oversight over the recommendations to make sure that everything is well aligned with what they're trying to accomplish and also in their best interest. Clients in general feel that there are conflicts of interest in the financial services industry. So there's quite a bit of research on the fact that the average client doesn't feel like there's anyone out there that they could hire who has their back, who has no conflict of interest, no commission on the line, no compensation at risk, that would actually be able to oversee the recommendations and the financial people that are in their financial life. So your role is going to be shifting to oversight. This is going to be the big takeaway of our message today. But I want for you to acknowledge in your thinking about this, what is oversight? So there are people in your client's financial life currently, and those are the people that are actually doing the implementation. As I said, the client's thinking they're doing the oversight, but what I'm going to recommend to you in your journey to become indispensable, the starting place is to build your own oversight team, a team that will oversee the client's financial, personal financial affairs in all areas, a team that will oversee the implementation of everything in a client's financial life. So this is the team that you will build. Now, we've talked about this in the past. This is the model that is different than what clients are used to. It's a very simple model. In the past, ideal clients have dealt directly with their own tax person. They've dealt directly with their money manager. If they had a financial planner, which most don't, they would deal directly with the financial planner, and they would deal with their own legal estate planning attorney, and of course, they deal with their own insurance agents. In our model, you build an oversight team, including subject matter experts in each of these areas of finance. You play the orchestra conductor for that team, and you then swivel around to the audience, as it were, which is the ideal client, and you are the single simple point of contact for that client. Now, you're not trying to prevent the client from interacting with these other people, and there will be times that they might interact with these folks directly. It's just easier to directly interact with a subject matter expert when they're working on an issue with a client at times. But for the most part, as the client's most trusted advisor, you're their single simple point of contact. You're the individual that understands what they're trying to achieve, and you convey that to the others. All the information and documents to create a comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy flow through you and then are distributed out to the team so that they can collaborate and establish and finalize an overall lifetime strategy for the client. So, we can admit, however, this being the oversight team, clients already have people in their financial life when you first meet them. Oftentimes, a client has a tax person already in their life. A client already has a money manager in their life. A client might already have an attorney, an estate planning attorney, and a client certainly has insurance agents before they meet you. So this is what we call the implementation team. These are the individuals that actually are implementing the client's financial affairs. The problem is, and this is the problem that you will solve for them, there is no overarching strategy. And number two, these people aren't talking to each other. Almost never is that the case. There's very seldom, if ever, a financial strategy in place overarching everything, and the people aren't collaborating. The financial people in a client's life are not collaborating anyway. Therefore, there's a need for the oversight team. Now, what does the oversight team do, and exactly, how do they do it? So I'm going to put all this in the context of what we recommend in this program, that you are going to make an advisor pact with each and every one of your clients. And PACT is an acronym, and we're going to spend some time today talking about how do you turn this advisor pact that you would make with each and every one of your ideal clients into an oversight promise that will relieve the client from feeling they have to be the one in charge of their own oversight so they can relax and they feel that you've got their back and that you're up to this task and they can be relieved of that responsibility and go out and focus on things that matter more in life to them. So more on that in just a minute. But let's focus back on the oversight team. So if you build a team with a tax expert, financial planner, money manager, estate planning attorney, and insurance expert, what exactly is it that they're doing? This is a paradigm shift for most advisors that we work with who are used to actually being on the implementation team. So advisors that we work with are typically accustomed to acquiring a client and then just beginning putting together perhaps a financial plan and then perhaps helping implement in some or all of these areas: tax, financial planning, money management, estate planning, insurance. What we're going to do by way of helping you understand this paradigm shift is to explain what is it that these people will be doing on your oversight team. So if they're not doing implementation, what are they doing? Well, I gave you a preview of that a moment ago. It's the job of the oversight team to establish what does not exist in most client situations, and that is an overarching strategy by which all the members of the implementation team will align their recommendations. Okay, so if a client doesn't have a strategy, then all these recommendations coming in from these various professionals aren't cohesive. They're not in alignment with what the client is trying to accomplish. So your oversight team is first and foremost responsible for establishing and then updating over time this overarching strategy so that it's clearly aligned with what the client is trying to accomplish financially. Then the other job, if your client's going to have implementation people in their life, for example, let's say a client owns a business and they've already got a tax subject matter expert in place, and that tax subject matter expert is doing both the business and the personal. Well, when we talk about making an advisor packed with every ideal client, what we are talking about is focusing on the client's personal financial affairs. Now, let me pause that right here for just a second. You may in the past, may or may not, you may have been offering business consulting as a part of your business in the past. I'm not recommending that you stop doing that. What I am recommending is that you separate that, the two services. And so that with your advisor pact that you're making with every ideal client, you are making promises to protect, to pay attention to coordinate, and provide full transparency regarding their personal financial affairs. If you are, in addition to that, offering business consulting, helping a client who, let's say, is a business owner, coordinate their business planning, just offer that as a separate service under a separate fee so that you can clearly focus on the two services. They are different. And in the personal financial affairs, if you have, in the hypothetical that I just gave you, a client that has a tax subject matter expert, for example, who's doing both the business and the personal, you're focusing on the personal side. And by building an oversight team, including a tax subject matter expert, in addition to creating the overarching strategy with the rest of the subject matter experts for this client, it's your tax subject matter expert's job and all of the subject matter experts' jobs on your oversight team to assess the current implementation team members. So they have to be skilled and they have to be willing to do this. What you'll find is there are a fair number of professionals that are either uncomfortable or, what is more probable, they're not skilled, although they may not tell you that, in really assessing the work of another professional, one of their peers. So you have to build your oversight team to make sure everyone on your team is sufficiently skilled and up to the task of assessing the implementation team members to make sure they're skilled and up to the job. To look at every implementation team member and assess how they are providing their services in alignment with the pact that we've made with the client. So PACT, as you well know, is an acronym standing for Protection, Attention, Coordination, and Transparency. So your oversight subject matter expert is going to look at the implementation professional corresponding to their skills and assess the recommendations that that individual makes. Is it protecting the clients? How well is it protecting the client? The recommendations coming from the implementation subject matter expert, are they paying attention? Are they paying adequate attention to the client's financial affairs? And are they coordinating with the others? So one of the great values of what we provide in truly comprehensive financial services delivered under an advisor-packed relationship is that your oversight team is going to insist and enforce that the implementation team coordinates with the others. So it's no longer are they going to work in isolation. Your oversight team is going to make sure that the client's tax implementation person, their estate planning implementation person, and so forth, all their implementation team are coordinating with each other and fully transparent. We've got a lot of research showing that clients do not understand fully what they're paying for their financial products and services. And so it's up to your oversight team to flush all that out and to make sure that for every financial product and for every financial individual working with this client, that the client is fully aware of what the costs are. And it's up to your oversight team to identify any potential conflicts of interest as it relates to the implementation team. So for example, if, let's say, use the insurance agents as an example. So the insurance agents that the client has represent the client's implementation team. So what's the job of your insurance subject matter expert? Well, in part, to determine if something that's recommended by the client's insurance agent, to identify if there's a commission that maybe is driving the recommendation, and to at least point out and identify and disclose to the client all potential conflicts of interest such as that. So this is the job of your implementation team, is to assess the job of your oversight team is to assess the implementation team. And as we've been discussing, it's up to your oversight team to qualify all implementation team recommendations to ensure that they're well aligned with the overarching strategy. So if a client has an accountant, if the client has an estate planning attorney or an insurance agent, those individuals are no longer going to deliver their recommendations directly to the client. They will deliver those recommendations to your oversight team. Your oversight team will review the recommendations and apply all the assessments, identify any potential conflicts, just basically qualify the recommendation to make sure it's well aligned with the strategy that your oversight team has created for this client, and then pass the recommendation along to the team to review every recommendation in advance. We're talking here about deliverables checkpoints, but deliverables checkpoints are a separate issue. But let's assume, as we recommend, that you come up with a specific set of deliverables checkpoints that every one of your ideal clients is going to cycle through on an annual basis. So in our case, we have developed 143 deliverables checkpoints that we apply to every ideal client on an annual basis. Those 143 deliverables checkpoints are distributed among our various subject matter experts: tax, financial planning, money, money management, insurance, and estate planning. So they're assigned and split up under those areas of personal finance. And you're going to develop your own checkpoints. You're either going to, at some point, join the Trusted Advisor Toolkit and utilize our 143 deliverables checkpoints, or we'll show you how to develop your own deliverables checkpoints. Either way, it's the job of your oversight team to make sure that all those deliverables checkpoints get done. Some of those checkpoints might be oversight checkpoints, which are going to be vested with your oversight team. Other checkpoints are implementation checkpoints, which are going to be assigned to the implementation team. In both cases, it's the job of your oversight team to ensure that all the deliverables checkpoints get done. And I guess in the end, it's your oversight team is vested with the responsibility to ensure that the client goals are, whether they're on track or off track. Just the status of every goal should be updated for the client at every meeting. This requires behind the scenes. Does your oversight team know whether every goal is on track or off track? They should. This is a responsibility of your oversight team to not only determine whether a client's stated goals are on track or off track, but if they're not on track, to quickly identify that fact and to identify this need for a course correction and collaborate with the others on the team to make recommendations to get that client back on track to the goals that they say that they want to accomplish. So it's the responsibility of your oversight team just to make sure that the strategy is unfolding properly and specifically related to the client goals, to get the status of those goals, identify whether they're on or off track prior to every client progress meeting, quickly identify whenever a client's financial affairs have drifted even one degree off course, and to quickly make recommendations to get the client back on track. So the question might be occurring to you, can an oversight team member also be a member of the implementation team? The answer is yes, but there's an if, and it's a very, very big if. Now, this is also a paradigm shift. So this is going to require you to sit down with each and every subject matter expert on your team and explain this issue of the difference between oversight and implementation. Oversight is the primary role. Many of your subject matter experts are not going to grasp this right away because they're used to being compensated for doing the work. Yet, if you're going to become indispensable, you've got to get the client off the hook of thinking that their role is oversight. If you can get your team on board with this concept, you'll build the foundation of becoming indispensable to your clients. By taking over that role that the client feels like there is nobody out there to take on, you'll start taking the burden of oversight off the client's shoulders, and little by little, the client will actually very quickly begin to recognize how indispensable you are because you've got their back, and you are overseeing all the implementation of all their personal financial affairs so that they don't have to do that anymore. So can an oversight member of your team also be an implementation team member? Yes, if they will acknowledge and accept that their primary role is oversight, not implementation. And in addition to that, they have to convince you as the trusted advisor that if they also do the implementation, if they will, in addition to being on the oversight team, they want to be on the implementation team for the client as well, because there's generally compensation that goes with that. They've got to convince you that it's not going to compromise their oversight responsibilities, which come first. So you're going to have to require this professional to disclose the potential conflicts of interest that being on both teams will create, and to disclose that in writing. And when they make these disclosures, I keep using a tax expert, but that's a very good one, because tax firms typically have this figured out. Let's say a tax expert says, look, I will provide oversight for tax for your clients, but I also want to do implementation. And so we at our firm will do the client's taxes, and we will provide oversight over all their tax planning. And the way that we will do this, and the way they're convincing the trusted advisor that this is not going to compromise their oversight responsibilities, is saying the way we do it is we have another junior accountant in our firm actually prepare the taxes for this client. And then as an oversight role, your tax subject matter expert at that firm, the person who's actually on your team, will be in a review position. So the person who's actually on your team may hypothetically convince you, I'm not doing the tax return. Another person at our firm is doing that. And your tax expert is simply reviewing that, which is an oversight function. And if you are confident and you see the process and you disclose this to the client, that it's all happening under one roof at one firm, both the implementation and the oversight, well, maybe they can convince you. Accountants typically have figured this out, how they can properly provide both oversight and implementation without compromising the oversight responsibilities. However, I think we can all agree it does create an appearance of a conflict, and that needs to be provided to the client if you're going to do both. So, yes, if they cannot convince you that they can do both, then your primary need for your subject matter expert is in the area of oversight. If they tell you point blank, look, I'm good at implementation, I don't want to provide oversight over other professionals, I just want to do what I do and be on the implementation team, then you can politely disengage from that subject matter expert, because they're unwilling to do what you need them to do most, and that is oversight, because that's what's going to make you and your team indispensable. So let me fly through this. You're going to make an advisor pact with your clients. This advisor pact I'm proposing is going to be all about oversight. So let me just fly through this real quick. You're going to address by making an advisor pact with your client, you're going to address their biggest issue, and they may have not even thought of it this way until you bring it up. But we have data on this. Affluent clients think they're alone in this oversight role, and as far as protection is concerned, particularly alone. They think if anybody's going to protect their financial affairs, if anybody's going to watch over their money and protect it, it's going to be them. It's going to be up to you and your oversight team of subject matter experts to convince this client that you've got their back. You can protect them. They are not alone. One of the things, and I'm going to give you some ideas here of how you take this advisor pact and what you do with it to specifically give guidance to your team of subject matter experts that's helping provide oversight. One of the things I want you to think about is neglect. So clients have their money in all these big institutions. They've got their money sitting in banks. They have their money sitting in investment custodial firms. All these entities where clients have their money, the client perceives that they are just a number. They are not so much of a client as they are a number. And it is true that clients are often neglected at these institutions where they have their money. Also at insurance companies, pretty much every big company that your client deals with related to their personal financial affairs, they're at risk of negligence. Negligence only from the standpoint of they're not really viewing this client individually. That's the job of your team. So the direction you give your team is in each of their areas of personal, each narrow field of personal finance that your oversight team is responsible, tell them you want them to think about how to protect the client from the neglect that comes from just dealing with big institutions. Also, this is a way to view the implementation team. Is your oversight team assessing whether the implementation team people are neglecting the client? And by neglecting the client, not spending enough time protecting the client or not making efforts to even attempt to protect the client, what we're filling a gap in is the area of neglect. So it's the idea that you're on top of this, protecting the client and not allowing anybody on the team, no institution, no individual, to neglect this client. And that protects the client. Also, incompetence. We talked about assessing the implementation team. It's a continual job for your oversight team in overlooking the work of the implementation team to make sure that there's competent work, that you're protecting the client from poor quality work, and sometimes it's just careless errors, but either way, protecting from incompetence. And the key is just letting your clients know they're not alone, that you, very few advisors hold themselves out to the client, making a pact like this, that I view my role as increasing the safety of your plan. I'm looking at your assets, I'm looking at your strategy, we're watching the people implementing, you're not alone in viewing everything, all your financial affairs from the standpoint of protection. And when you look at what clients say, when you survey and do research on affluent clients, you'll find that affluent people will say many of us don't trust financial advisors. And I always recommend that you broach the subject and just state it as a fact. Ask your best clients, why is it that do you think that so many affluent people don't trust their financial advisors? What is it that they don't trust? And let them know that you have completely transformed your business because of this kind of belief on the part of potential clients. And so you have reorganized your business to address all these things that clients don't trust about financial advisors. So get your clients to say, here's what I think, deal with it in third person. Get your clients, your best clients, to tell you, here's what I think it is that affluent people don't trust about financial advisors. And let them just tell you, and then tell them, explain that through this advisor pact, that's how you have addressed all of this. You are addressing these same issues that affluent people don't trust, and you've transformed your business to solve that. And then attention. Is the implementation team paying attention to the client's changing situation? Client's circumstances change. They get married, they get divorced, they have children, they have grandchildren, there are deaths in the family, they get new jobs, they get laid off from big corporations, they own their business goes into severe decline, then there are periods of robust growth. Things are continually changing. And then we're not even talking about the changing financial markets. So on top of all of this, if a client's got their money invested in the financial markets, that's changing as well. So is everybody on the team, your oversight team and your oversight team looking over the implementation team, is everyone paying attention? It's up to your oversight team to make sure that everybody's paying attention and quickly identifies when a client's situation has changed. We're not talking about it in this session, but as you know, we recommend the 3-meeting process. Well, without getting into that too deeply, the 3-meeting process ensures that you're meeting with every ideal client at least once every 4 months. I would say that's a good measure for this. Are you identifying major changes in your client's situation at least once every 4 months so that no period beyond 4 months goes by when a change in your client's situation, which would actually affect their financial affairs, is not overlooked by your team? So this is the pact. This is what you need to give direction to your team to make sure they're doing, paying attention to client changes, but also paying attention to the money. So who's watching the money? How closely are they watching it? Are they looking at the performance? Your oversight person should be looking at and paying attention to the money and mainly making sure that the money management team, whoever's managing the money for the client on the implementation team, that they're paying attention to the money. This is direction you give to your oversight team. Pay attention. Same goes for taxes. Your tax expert needs to be asking this question. Who's paying attention to the client's taxable events? The client's selling securities, the client's selling a business, the client's selling a home. Anytime there's a taxable event, it's your oversight team person's job to make sure that everybody on the team's paying attention and being proactive about this. Estate planning, paying attention to the people that are named in the estate. I mean, clients name beneficiaries, clients name control people in their estate, trustees, executors, and so forth. And then they change their mind. They want their money to go to different people as a beneficiary from time to time, or new people come into the into their life, like grandchildren and things like that. So it's the job of your oversight team to make sure that that everybody's paying attention to the people in the client's life, and as especially as it relates to their estate plan. Paying attention to the improved safety of the strategy. I mean, the whole idea is of protection is that we're on top of things. We're paying attention. If something drifts off course and it creates then a risk to the strategy, we're paying attention. We're paying close attention, as we've said all along. And you're paying attention to the quality of the oversight. This is the oversight team on your oversight team making sure that every recommendation is well aligned with the overarching strategy, and the quality of the advice is very high. Let's say a recommendation comes in from one of the client's implementation team members, and your oversight person looks at it, and because your oversight team member is so skilled and so experienced at what they do, they look at that recommendation and they think, well, it's a, you know, the problem with this recommendation is it's not high quality enough, it's not specific enough, or it's not something. And so that is where your oversight team person shows their value. They coordinate and collaborate and provide leadership over the implementation team to increase the quality of the recommendation. Work with that implementation team member to get the quality of their recommendation up to the standard that it needs to be. And just thinking how clients view this area of attention as it relates to the financial services industry, the research we've done is that affluent people often feel, in my experience, financial advisors are not on top of things. They've seen it. They've seen too many changing situations in their lives that that their financial advisor was not aware of, wasn't paying attention, wasn't asking the right questions, and either never knew that the change occurred, or it was up to the client in their oversight role over their own affairs to, you know, be on top of it and try to remember to tell their advisor everything. I'm suggesting that if your goal is to become indispensable, you flip that and you improve your process to make sure that you're paying attention and asking the right questions so that you're aware of all these changes. Coordination. The idea of making a pact with every client that you're going to coordinate all their personal financial affairs. What are you going to coordinate? Well, we're going to coordinate the people. We're going to coordinate all the implementation people in the client's life. And as the oversight team, we're going to be transparent. We're going to be doing all this coordination of the people in such a way that the client's not bothered by it, not involved, but yet the product is obvious. The people are on their financial team are obviously coordinating with each other. That you can tell, the client can tell from the recommendations that everything that's being recommended is well aligned with everything that they're trying to accomplish, and and that the people are well coordinated. And your oversight team is also, as we keep mentioning, coordinating the recommendations that the implementation team is making. And from a perspective of a client, the research that we've done is clients, affluent clients, often feel that they've never met a financial advisor who's actually coordinating everything. Now, let me tell you the measure that the clients often put on this. You can give this as a form of direction to your oversight team that what the goal here is in this coordination is to actually make the client's to-do list smaller. So you want to provide indispensable value to a client, give them the gift of time. Most financial advisors are not really good at giving a list of, you know, a kind of a step-by-step list of action items that need to accomplish to implement their comprehensive written lifetime financial strategy. Most advisors don't even work off of a list that's consistent, but many do. But the problem with those that do is that a financial advisor will identify all the things that need to happen, and then they just end up creating this gigantic list that they give to the client, who's sitting there staring at this list, thinking to themselves, "That's all I need is a lot more stuff to do." And so in your role of coordination to address this problem, to become indispensable, make it in addition to identifying the checklist, step-by-step list of action items required for this client, make it your job of your oversight team to go the extra mile and to figure out ways to get these things done for the client, or to get involved enough to make it easier for the client. Like, rather than tell the client to go meet with their estate planning lawyer about this and that, whatever's on the checklist, your oversight lawyer set, you know, or their administrative support person sets the appointment for the client, you know, just takes care of all this for the client. Perhaps, you know, in our firm, our estate planning subject matter expert would always do a pre-briefing and a post-briefing of the client meeting with their attorney, so that, you know, it reduces billable hours. The client walks into the lawyer meeting and the lawyer already knows the situation because they've already been briefed. Anyway, situations like that. What can you do to coordinate your client's financial affairs, financial people, in such a way that it makes their list of action items smaller, not larger? And then finally, transparency. What can you do in the area of transparency that will help the client, you know, identify potential conflicts of interest and fully understand what it is that they're paying for their financial services and their financial products? So when we're talking about financial product transparency, this is going to come very, this always is an awkward subject, but this is the differentiator. You want to become indispensable to your client, disclose all your commissions, disclose from the past, disclose what the current people in the client's financial life not only have made in the past. So just pick an arbitrary period, like 10 years, say, look, here are all the financial people in your life, Mr. Client. Over the last 10 years, we estimate, here's the dollar figure, or if you're in the UK, the pound sterling, here's the amount that you have compensated that individual over the last, let's say, 10 years. And that's stunning to the client at times. But what builds trust faster than disclosure? We have found that when clients are disclosed in this manner about the financial products and also about the compensation transparency, that clients are first and foremost, they're often surprised, but the second reaction is gratitude. Most clients realize they don't fully understand how they're paying for things and how they're paying their people. And you being the solution to that big problem, I would say this is one of the biggest areas where if you want to become indispensable, you will build up your value fastest by disclosing compensation and disclosing how much clients are paying for financial products and services. And Clients feel this way. When we research clients, they have a perspective that my current financial advisor is free. How many of you have heard that? You talk to a potential client, they go, hey, my current financial advisor doesn't cost me anything. But they know there's no free lunch and they don't fully trust it. They don't understand exactly what's happening. But they know down deep there's something, they're paying something. You being the solution to disclose all of that really builds up credibility on your part as being the individual that will be indispensable because you're able and willing to provide oversight for this client so they don't have to. So all that to say this, your advisor pact that you make with each and every ideal client is all about oversight. This oversight will lead to a feeling that you are taking over something that clients up until now have felt like is they can't find anybody to do for them. And by taking over that oversight function, you have built up the biggest chit of anybody in their financial life, the client's financial life, in terms of being indispensable. Okay, let's prepare for an extraordinary client meeting experience. Let me start by saying that when we research affluent people, they do not like their meetings with their financial advisors. There's a big problem and a big disconnect. For one thing, if you listen to clients, often feel that financial advisors are one of two things. They're either overcomplicated in terms of their description and their conversation with clients about what's going on or about the recommendations. So either the conversations are unnecessarily complicated and they're talking over the client's head, or there's some sales motive. So clients often feel, why go into these client meetings? Because there's just some sales motive here. The advisor's trying to sell something. So those are the two most common perspectives that clients bring to the table when they, you know, think about meeting with their financial advisor. It's not fun for them. Oftentimes, and we are the same, we recommend that you only hold client meetings with both spouses present. However, if the meetings are boring, if the advisor is perceived as talking over the client's head or focusing on, you know, financial technical talk, or making a sales pitch, if these are the perceptions on a client's part of why they're coming into the office, why on earth would I want my spouse to have to suffer through that too? So you have this, and also this additional dynamic of, you know, clients don't want to attend, but they recognize they need to meet with their financial advisor periodically. So, okay, we'll meet with the financial advisor, but because the meetings are not fun and because the meetings are not interesting and not dealing with the issues that are foremost in the client's mind, I'm not going to put my spouse through this. So I'm going to fight with the advisor about not having my spouse attend. So let's flip this around. What's the advisor typically doing? Well, most advisors don't do much of anything. Most advisors, in our study of this, most advisors do not do a tremendous amount in their preparation for a client meeting. What happens is, for most advisors, they develop a methodology, a way of preparing for a client meeting that is fast, efficient, and replicatable, and they just kind of do that over and over, and somewhat unaware of the client's concerns, you know. And so we're going to flip all that's on its head. Another thing, we're going to set up a scenario where every client meeting is so well prepared that we are giving tremendous amount of attention on the internal team into this client meeting. The client's coming in. This client meeting, we're going to treat as a project. We're going to treat every client progress meeting as a project, and a project that everybody on our team is going to have some input. And we're going to focus on creating an extraordinary client meeting experience, starting first and foremost with the preparation piece, making sure we're well prepared. And another problem that we have encountered internally is the idea that there is a need to move from chaos to calm and calmness and consistency prior to these client progress meetings. So this may not be your office, but I'm sure even if this is not the rule, I think most financial advisors have had this experience from time to time, where you're literally preparing reports for clients as they arrive at the door, and for one reason or another, things waited to the last minute, and we're just now, as the client's arriving, or maybe the day before the client's arriving, we're just now creating all the reports, the analysis, the opinions, the whatever we're going to be using to support the client meeting. It's all being kind of pushed to the last minute. And so as a result, there's a certain amount of chaos about this. And even if the team is not chaotic in producing these reports at the last minute, I'm going to propose that if you don't have the time as an advisor to really calmly think through all the points that need to be made in priority at this client meeting, then mentally the advisor is often a little bit mentally chaotic because things are pushed to the last minute. So we're going to deal with that. What we're going to propose is a new concept. We're going to insert a process before every client progress meeting that's going to help you prepare for each meeting and set the stage for the advisor being able to calmly and carefully create an extraordinary client meeting experience. So we're recommending that what you're going to do is you're going to institute what we call the dry run prep meeting. Dry run prep meeting is 7 to 10 days prior to every client progress meeting. So this is a week to 10 days before every client progress meeting, you have this dry run prep meeting. So what is it? Let's start with a definition. The dry run prep meeting is an internal meeting. So it's an internal meeting. That means your client is not present. And I would propose that the dry run prep meeting is the most important meeting benefiting your clients. And I want you to think about this, and the client's not even present. But if you will institute this dry run prep meeting, it's an internal meeting with your subject matter experts that you're going to hold a week to 10 days before every client meeting. Now, subject matter experts, what does that mean? Well, we continually come back to our model. The model is you are the single, simple point of contact as your client's most trusted advisor. This is our oversight team structure. This would be a visual that you would show to a client where you explain to a client, they're in green, that's you. You are the client. Your single point of contact is me. I'll be your trusted advisor, and I will understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and I'll receive from you all the information and documents that we need in order to do our job, and then I'll swivel my chair around, much as an orchestra conductor does, and I'll begin conducting an orchestra, which is our oversight team that I have built of a tax expert, a money management team, a financial planning subject matter expert, an estate planning subject matter expert, a lawyer, and an insurance subject matter expert. So we've got an oversight team. And my point for the dry run prep meeting is all of these individuals should contribute to the meeting with the client, and therefore they are going to contribute to the dry run prep meeting, which happens a week or so before the client meeting. And as a matter of fact, the whole idea of the dry run prep meeting is this is the venue for your subject matter experts to provide the value of all the work that they've done for this client. So the dry run prep meeting is where they actually are given center stage to provide their recommendations and action items and their analysis and their opinions and every important thing that they are doing to help this client achieve their financial objectives. So What does the dry run prep meeting resolve? What are the problems that, what created the need for the dry run prep meeting? Well, the dry run prep meeting resolves the fact that all client reports and data have to be completed in advance of the client meeting. So it just creates a deadline well in advance of the client meeting so that there's none of this waiting to the last minute. There's no rush at the end. There's no chaos. Everything calms down immediately because we've created a false deadline. We've got this dry run prep meeting and all the reports and data, everything going to be used in the client meeting is going to be ready for that dry run prep meeting. So it also just creates a deadline for them to collaborate with each other. So this whole idea of that our oversight team, the value of having an oversight team is that there is a team that's actually talking to each other across these narrow fields of finance. And, they are collaborating, providing peer review and understanding what each other are recommending to the benefit of the client. So we've got a deadline now to get all that collaboration completed. Not only a deadline to turn in documents for the meeting, but also a deadline for your subject matter experts to collaborate and touch base with each other to make sure that everything that's being recommended is well aligned with the overarching strategy. And by having a dry run prep meeting a week before the client meeting, it also allows for what, let's call it a quiet period. Prior to the meeting. So you've had the dry run prep meeting, and now there's a quiet period where the trusted advisor can actually plan to deliver an extraordinary client meeting experience. So let's look at the calendar and see how this would work. Let me just kind of show you how it would work. So here is on the 17th, we've got Ted and Lynn Smith. They're coming in for a client progress meeting. So the clients are coming into the office and we're going to meet with them. So when would we put the dry run prep meeting? Well, the dry run prep meeting, this internal meeting, is going to happen a week to 10 days before the client meeting. So let's say the 7th. So on the 7th, we're going to have an internal meeting with our subject matter experts where they are provided a venue to share all the fabulous work that they've done on behalf of this client for this meeting that we're holding. Now, one thing that makes this work and makes this work very well is the fact that everything this team of subject matter experts is going to submit for discussion at the dry run prep meeting is actually turned in advance to your office and your administrative support person that we call your administrative manager. Receives all the work that they, your subject matter experts, has completed for the dry run prep meeting, but that's got to be received in advance of the dry run prep meeting. Otherwise, if you don't get all their work before the dry run prep meeting, how on earth will the subject matter experts be able to provide any kind of oversight or peer review on the other's recommendations? Because if they're just being presented with all the great ideas of the other subject matter experts at the dry run prep meeting, there's not really enough time for them to think and contemplate on what's being recommended. So the administrative manager, your administrative support person, is going to create a deadline prior to the dry run prep meeting. In this case, like 2 business days prior to the dry run prep meeting, your administrative manager says, look, everything's due. All your analysis, all your recommendations, all your any reports that you've created, everything. Everything's due prior to 2 business days prior to the actual dry run prep meeting. And so in this case, all documents are submitted by the subject matter expert to your administrative manager a couple of business days before, that's Friday. So your administrative manager is then tasked with making sure that everybody else on the team is able to have access to all this information. So your administrative manager notifies and distributes every subject matter expert on the team, that we are now in possession of all the analysis and opinions and memorandums and reports, and everything that the subject matter experts has been working on is now in our possession, and we're going to provide that to everybody else on the team to stimulate their thinking and to help them prepare for coming to the dry run prep meeting and understanding what the others' recommendations are. So then on the 7th, you have the dry run prep meeting. And then we have a full 10 days where the trusted advisor is now has been fully presented with all the work of your subject matter experts and is now able to invest 10 days as a quiet period to think about everything that's been submitted and to quietly contemplate what would be the most powerful, extraordinary client meeting experience that would have the most impact for this client. So that's the way the dry run prep meeting works. So now you're sitting, let's say, in a dry run prep meeting. What's the agenda? What do we talk about? What are we actually doing? And how long is this meeting? Well, there's a 3-point agenda at the dry run prep meeting. The first is every subject matter expert contributes. So it can't leave the dry run prep meeting until every subject matter expert has contributed, either recommendations or peer review. Either they've got their own action items that they're recommending that this client needs to follow, or they will sit back and they will provide a very stimulative, collaborative peer review of the recommendations the others are making, so that we're testing everything by fire in a very collegial manner, and so every subject matter expert contributes. So we use that contribution objective to make sure that every recommendation and every action item from every subject matter expert is fully reviewed in this dry run prep meeting. Secondly, now that we've reviewed all the recommendations, we prioritize them. So the second agenda item at a dry run prep meeting is to take all the recommendations from your subject matter experts and prioritize them. So the most important recommendations at the top and the least important recommendation is at the bottom of the list. And then the third and final objective of a dry run prep meeting is just simply to finalize the client agenda. So you've got the recommendations prioritized. Now you need to decide what's the highest priority conversation. And you go around, every subject matter expert contributes, and you determine what each subject matter expert thinks is important. So every subject matter expert contributes, and I mentioned they're going to contribute in one of several ways. So if a subject matter expert tells you on your team, well, I don't have much to contribute today, so I'm just going to sit back and listen to the others. No, that's not the standard. Everybody's going to contribute. So those subject matter experts that come to the dry run prep meeting with recommendations, they're going to provide those. Those subject matter experts that may not have recommendations, but they definitely have action items that the client needs to be aware of or needs to take action on, those are established. So some subject matter experts have recommendations or action items. For all the rest, they're going to contribute, but they're going to contribute by peer review. They're going to listen to the recommendations of the others, and they're going to question those recommendations. They're going to dissect them, and they're going to view the recommendation from every angle as a professional, and I said in a very collegial manner, provide peer review. Once all the recommendations have been reviewed, then your subject matter expert's job is to prioritize the greatest probability strategy, the GPS. Now, I'm going to show you what that is. This, for some of you, this is a new term. It's a report, and I'll show you what it is in a minute. We call it the client's GPS. But let me just say this before we show you what the GPS looks like. What we're talking about here is simply prioritizing every recommendation. We've got all the recommendations. Now we've got to prioritize them. And all the GPS is taking the prioritized recommendations and splitting them into three sections. So we're going to have section number 1 is those action items and recommendations that are due by our next meeting. And then you put the date of the meeting. So you're going to have a GPS report, and you're going to have all the recommendations prioritized that are due before the next time we meet 4 months from now. Second section, section number two, is those action items and recommendations that are due by year end. So before December 31st of this calendar year, whatever calendar year you're in. So those action items and recommendations are listed in this section number two. And then finally, third section, there's a section of future years, future dates. And so you list year by year, every year in which your subject matter experts have a recommendation. So for example, take the client's goals, for example. So let's say you have a client that has financial independence. You're going to put the year that that's going to occur in section three. And so let's just say hypothetically that's the year 2024, financial independence. So you're going to show the year 2024, and you're going to write the goal, financial independence, and whatever the goal is, $80,000 per year, net after taxes, to begin on a certain date. And then you list anything that leads up to that goal. So maybe a year prior, you're going to have, discuss funding plan for financial independence goal occurring the next calendar year. So you're going to use that third section to list all future action items, anything that's envisioned by the strategy that your subject matters experts have created for this client. Every year that they've envisioned anything happening, that will be noted on the GPS. So there's three sections on the GPS. And in each section, you're going to have everything prioritized. Highest priority recommendation is at the top, and the lowest priority recommendation is at the bottom. So let me show you an example of one. So here is a GPS. This is just page one. They're typically two or three pages long. This is page one, which is the first section that we were talking about. So this is the we call it the greatest probability strategy. Short name is the GPS. And it's simply a prioritized listing of every recommendation made by your subject matter experts. So it's a single place where all the recommendations are listed from your team. As I said, section number one represents all the action items and recommendations that are due before the next client meeting. And so you'll say action items due by, and that July 12th would be the next meeting with this client. And then you just list in priority order all the recommendations that need to be done between now and the next meeting. It really simplifies it for the client. It removes from this list everything that doesn't need to be done between now and the next meeting. You're going to put that in other sections. But they've got all three sections. They know what needs to be done between now and the next meeting, and then what are the remaining items that need to be done the rest of this calendar year. And then section three is just listing year by year after that anything else that the team is envisioning that needs to happen. So you've really simplified this for the client. After they see the whole report, they can just reduce their attention to this first section. They just focus what needs to happen between now and our next meeting. As I said, the recommendations are listed in order of importance. They're in priority because in later sessions, we'll talk about how to execute the actual client meeting. This, what we're talking about now, is preparing for an extraordinary client progress meeting. In later sessions, we'll talk about executing an extraordinary client progress meeting. So the point is, once you execute a client progress meeting in an extraordinary way, you're going to make reviewing these recommendations a timed exercise so that you don't spend all day with the client. We execute an extraordinary client meeting experience in 60 minutes. So you get everything done in 60 minutes. And what's required there is to create a timed exercise where you go through these recommendations. We devote typically 15 minutes to the GPS. So if you're starting at the top of the list in the client meeting, the number one item that needs to be discussed should be item number one. and number two should be the second highest priority item, and so forth. So that as you're going through this, talking to the client and reviewing these recommendations, if you run out of time, you can end by saying, well, just glance at all the rest of these here. I'll give you a second to look them over. If you have any questions, let me know. Otherwise, we're going to move on. And clients are almost always okay with that because they recognize that the less priority, the less important priority items are at the bottom. Now, this is a team discipline that's really important for you to catch on this whole GPS thing. If a recommendation is not listed on the GPS, then it should be not considered to be a recommendation from your team. So what I've found over the years is that, at least at the beginning, subject matter experts are not used to this. So let's say we flash forward 4 months to our next meeting with this client. We gave them this GPS, and now you're in the dry run prep meeting, not for this meeting, but for the next one 4 months from now. And somebody on your team says, the client's off track because they failed to do something. And so your immediate reaction is to pull the GPS out and to see if that recommendation was on there. And what you'll find, at least in the beginning, is that it takes a team discipline to remember and to be thorough enough to put every recommendation on here. And so by setting this standard and telling your team, look, if it's not on the GPS, it's not a formal recommendation from our team. So if a client needs to do something in order to be on track, make sure it's listed here. It's either going to be done between now and the next meeting or at some point in the future. Either way, it'll be on this GPS somewhere. So don't sit there and tell me that a client didn't do something if it's not listed on here. It's the responsibility of your subject matter experts to make sure everything gets on here. Everything that needs to happen is listed here. If it's an action item, if it's a recommendation, it's going to be here. And that's going to often take a little bit of time and a little bit of an adjustment on your team to comply with, to get that done. So as far as high standards, this is really important to preparing for an extraordinary client meeting experience. And when I start to talk about how long should this dry run prep meeting take, well, the dry run prep meeting is going to take 20 minutes. And this is a big if your subject matter experts are prepared. If they're prepared, and that means if all the recommendations, all the thorough recommendations that they have submitted for this client, for this dry run prep meeting, if they meet all of the proper objectives and they don't have superfluous information in them, and I'll cover those in just a minute. But all that to say this, you've got to create some standards around what is submitted by your subject matter experts prior to the dry run prep meeting, or else the dry run prep meeting can last a long time. I've been in dry run prep meetings that lasted 2 hours, and that is because the subject matter experts weren't prepared and their recommendations weren't up to the standard. So let's go through the standards real quick so that you can get those into place. So subject matter expert work. So I talk about there are 10 common reasons that you might reject the work of a subject matter expert. So what does work mean? You have to create standards that you will reject the work of a subject matter expert under certain circumstances. That will make the recommendations more coherent, more concise, more compelling, and at the end of the day, just more clear. So what is work? So work might be a document that's submitted before the dry run prep meeting. Maybe you've assigned a deliverables checkpoint. We always recommend that subject matter experts, for anything that's assigned to them, they submit a document. That way we've got something to share with the other subject matter experts, which is the whole point. We want our team to collaborate. That's one of the big values that we provide that other financial advisors don't bother with. And so we need a document from every subject matter expert for everything assigned, such as deliverables checkpoints assigned to a subject matter expert. How about reports? Subject matter experts are going to create reports for these client meetings. That's an example of work. They may create an action item, something that needs to be done to keep this financial strategy on track for this client. That's work that they would submit. A recommendation, by the same token, if we're actually recommending something to be done, maybe not just an action item, an actual recommendation on the part of our team, that would be work. Any kind of analysis, any kind of opinion memo, anything that's submitted by a deliverables team member who's contributing to this client progress meeting is considered work. So what are the 10 most common reasons that you might reject the work of a subject matter expert? Well, let me just start by saying is you've got to create standards. And this is what I recommend that you create as a standard to share with your subject matter experts, that if your work comes in like this, then I'm just going to turn it right back around to you to fix it. Okay, so first and foremost, if your subject matter experts are submitting reports, which they will, we recommend that you have an agreed upon format for every report. Now, if you're working in the toolkit, we have other sessions where we describe what these reports look like. We call them toolkit reports. We've got the 5 critical reports, which you may already be implementing. We've got progress reports, all in specific formats. And the point here is if you're following the toolkit formats or if not, create your own format. The point is, if you could and should reject reports if they're not close enough to the model, if you've established an agreed upon format. So just give it back to the subject matter expert and have them redo it. If you've got a format, make sure that you, in advance of the dry run prep meeting, give it back to the subject matter expert to resubmit using the previously agreed upon format. Client education. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because some of you will have to kind of think this through. In the past, financial advisors thought this is actually our role, is to provide client education. And in our model, which we call truly comprehensive financial services, we do not provide client education. It's not our job to educate the client. It's our job to put a team of experts on to the client's financial objectives, to ponder those, create an overarching strategy, and then to make sure everything that needs to get done gets done. So we're focused on action items and recommendations. We are not going to sit there and educate the client because we only work with financial delegators. Truly comprehensive financial services delivered by a team of subject matter experts is focused on clients who are financial delegators. Therefore, they don't need to know why they're doing something. We're not educating them about tax law or estate planning law or money management. We're not the financial markets or any of that. We are mainly just saying, here's what you do. We need you to put $20,000 in this account number, blah, blah, blah. That's an action item. And so what you'll find is if you see, prior to a dry run prep meeting, a subject matter expert that submits kind of this long narrative, which ends up being, client education, explaining to, here's how this works, then you reject it. This is a common reason to reject the work of a subject matter expert and explain to them, I understand that maybe what's happening here is you don't know enough about the client to actually come in with a single, clear, concise recommendation. So the question shifts. What do you need to know? What information that's in the client's head, or what documentation are you missing so that rather than provide this long client education to the client, that you just come in with a recommendation saying, look, we've studied all the aspects of this. We know what you're trying to accomplish, Mr. Client, and here's what our team recommends that you do. So we're going to make it life simple for the client. We're going to weigh in with a recommendation, and we're going to reject any subject matter expert that submits some form of client education. The kissing cousin of that is giving the client options, and that's any subject matter expert that submits work prior to a dry run prep meeting saying, well, you know, I've looked at the client's situation and they could do this or they could do that. So the choice is, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? That's a recommendation we would reject. So again, what is it that you need to know so that you can give one recommendation rather than two or more options to a client? So this giving client options is a common reason to reject the work of a subject matter expert. What you'll find is some of the work submitted to by a subject matter expert represents fact-finding. So they're basically investing... they've submitted a document, they've invested their time just trying to better understand the client. This would be a subject matter expert, for example, that says, I can't really give a recommendation because I don't know this, I don't know that. Are they in this situation? Are they in that situation? And so the subject matter expert's all mentally embroiled in this, I don't know enough about the client to weigh in with a recommendation. Again, so what you'll see is that type of a subject matter expert who's really not firm on the client's situation will submit work that looks like a fact finder. And I'm not saying that they absolutely have to do their fact finding. So the question is the client progress meeting an appropriate place to do that? And is the dry run prep meeting an appropriate place to do fact finding? I'm saying no. You reject fact finding prior to the dry run prep meeting, and this is to be done prior to the dry run prep meeting. So the whole point of fact finding is for your subject matter experts to know to get that all done before the deadline to the dry run prep meeting so that they've got all the facts that they need. They're in possession of all the facts and they can weigh in with a single, compelling, concise recommendation. Fifth, something submitted that's not specific. So maybe they say, put the maximum in your retirement account before the end of the year. Well, it's not specific. A specific recommendation would say this: invest $20,000 in account number 222XYZ held with XYZ financial institution, and the deposit needs to be, make the check payable to TD Anytrade or whatever the firm is, and submit that check to our office before October 30th, 2014. So that's a specific recommendation, an amount of number, an account name, a deadline date, not something vague. So you should and need to get in the habit of rejecting anything that's submitted prior to the dry run prep meeting that's not specific. Unclear. You will find over time there will occasionally be recommendations that are incoherent or incomplete, or maybe they don't have a due date or something is unclear about the recommendation, just return it to the subject matter expert with that explanation that it needs to be more clear. And or commonly, you'll find subject matter experts that will give you the analysis, but not the work that backed it up. So for example, let's say you have a client that's purchasing a vehicle, and let's say they have an option to pay cash, they could finance the vehicle, or they could lease the vehicle. And so you approach your financial planning subject matter expert on this issue, and so what you get back prior to the dry run prep meeting is this client should finance this vehicle. And so you would return that work and reject it because I haven't seen, the analysis is not here. So it's kind of like back in third grade when your teacher said, you can't just give me the answer to the math problem. You have to show me your work. That's what we're talking about here. And it's just part of the peer review process. It's that the others on the team need to understand how the analysis was arrived at, how the recommendation was arrived at. They need to see the backup. And so you should reject anything submitted prior to a dry run prep meeting that doesn't include the backup work. You might reject a recommendation or some work of a subject matter expert if you feel that they have completely missed the boat on understanding the client's objectives. They don't understand the big picture or what the client's really trying to accomplish here. You're within your rights to return that to the subject matter expert, get them up to speed on what the objectives are, and get that fixed so that prior to the dry run prep meeting, we're not wasting time talking about recommendations that are just completely missing the point of what this client's trying to accomplish. So we're trying to save time in the dry run prep meeting just by creating a discipline of rejecting work if it's not concise. Number nine, this an action item or recommendation appears to carry undisclosed conflicts of interest. Please identify and disclose the conflicts. So, I don't know. Let's say you have a subject matter expert who's reviewed a recommendation from the client's insurance agent that the client should purchase a $200,000 variable annuity. I'll just pick a hypothetical recommendation. There's no commissions disclosed, and it's not clear to you as the trusted advisor that this recommendation has been vetted by your oversight team for these conflicts. The conflicts are undisclosed. It could be anything, but I'm just giving you a hypothetical. If you see a recommendation and it doesn't clearly disclose any potential conflicts of interest by the people making the recommendation, then you need to reject the recommendation and have your oversight team go back and finish that step. A big part of what we do is protect the client and give full transparency so that if there are any conflicts of interest, the client can rely on us. We've got their back. We're going to point out if somebody making a recommendation has a conflict of interest in any way that we can figure out. And then finally, number 10, if something's being recommended, but you have a sense there is no cost-benefit analysis, like, yes, we could do this recommendation, but when you take into account the cost of doing this versus the benefit the client will receive or the increased safety that the client will experience, has that been taken into account? If you feel like the cost-benefit analysis has not been fully looked at, you should develop a discipline of rejecting the work until that's done. So all these 10 things are common reasons that you would reject work that's been submitted prior to a dry run prep meeting. And if your team will get in the habit of, you won't have to do this very long until your team gets in the habit of not submitting work like this. You'll very quickly start to get work from your subject matter experts that doesn't have these problems. And what you're looking for is number 11. The 11th response to your subject matter expert is the most desired response. When you receive work from a subject matter expert, if they've done a great job and they've avoided the 10 most common reasons that you would reject their work, then the 11th response from you is to look at their work and say, this is perfect. Thank you very much. So, if these 10 reasons are cleared prior to every dry run prep meeting, then you don't have to worry about any of those 10 things. It's not going to drag out the conversation. It's going to be clear, concise recommendations. Then the dry run prep meeting will be completed in less than 30 minutes, which is the goal. As a matter of fact, the target for the dry run prep meeting is 20 minutes. And you will hit that target if you'll agree to instituting these disciplines of rejecting the work of your subject matter experts for these 10 most common reasons. So, One thing I will point out to you is that each of your subject matter experts is going to need a one-on-one orientation with you to discuss all these standards. This does not come naturally, even to the most experienced subject matter experts. I've been in this business 30 years. We've hired many financial planning subject matter experts, estate planning subject matter experts, tax, insurance. We've hired them all over the years. And I've hired many subject matter experts that have been in their narrow field of finance for well over 10 years, some well over 20 years. And I will tell you this for certain. I've never invited a subject matter expert, no matter how experienced they are, onto our team without them being shocked and dismayed at our high standards and have a reaction to them. And what we have to explain to them is this, and this is why you need to sit down with each and every subject matter expert to have this one-on-one expectations conversation. It's because you need to convey to them that what we're trying to do here, what we're seeking to accomplish, is to become indispensable to this client. That if we're not indispensable to one of our ideal clients, then that client is open to the approaches of another financial advisor who is going to claim that they're going to provide more value to the client. So if we capture the position, if we are successful in providing enough value to that client so that that client views us and calls us and describes us as indispensable, then that client will not be open to the approaches of other advisors. So this is a good business decision to become indispensable. And this is the way we do it. The other thing to make the point of is that one-on-one with a subject matter expert is that one thing they have to realize is these aren't our standards. These are the client's standards. This is what the client's claim they want most. This is what we call the four client expectations: protection, attention, coordination, transparency. The idea that clients complain that they can't find an advisor anywhere at any price to protect them, to pay enough attention to stay on top of the changing circumstances in their lives, to coordinate everything, not just pieces and parts, but the whole, all their personal financial affairs, coordinate everything, and that we've got their back. Everything's fully transparent and we're protecting them. We will identify potential conflicts. You know, what it really takes to provide value at the level that is impressive enough to a client that they would introduce us to other people that they care about, it's very, very high. So what I'm telling you is you need to sit down with the subject matter expert, have this one-on-one conversation, explain why you're going to require these high standards and why you're going to insist upon having a dry run prep meeting 7 to 10 days prior to the client meeting. You need to ensure before you get in too far into this that every one of your subject matter experts is both able and willing to do this. We have found that there are many skilled subject matter experts out there that really know their stuff, but they're unwilling to serve at this high level. They're unwilling to serve as a member of a team. So your job is to have a one-on-one session with them, make sure that they are both able and willing to do what you're asking and to maintain these high standards. And to confirm that every subject matter expert is up to the task, that they have, an administrative support person, so that they're well supported, that they have the skills and the experience to do what you need them to do. It doesn't matter if you've been working with a subject matter expert for a long time. Once you get into this and you start looking at what their qualifications are, and I'm not talking about certifications or letters after their name. I'm talking about, have they actually been delivering at this high level to people that meet your ideal client profile for a long time? When you start confirming that, you may find you need to change and upgrade your subject matter experts. So make sure that everyone you're working with is up to the task. And so we said the final thing in the three-point agenda for the dry run prep meeting is to finalize the client agenda. Well, that just means that every subject matter expert needs to come to the dry run prep meeting prepared with what they feel is the highest priority conversation for this meeting with this client. So every subject matter expert needs to be thoughtful about this and say, look, here's the biggest thing with this client. If we just had one important conversation with this client at this meeting, it should be this. And so that they're conveying to you as the trusted advisor who's actually going to be the representative of the team in the client progress meeting, who's having these conversations, your job is to have a discussion at the dry run prep meeting with your subject matter experts to determine what each of them feels is the highest priority conversation and to determine what you're actually going to discuss. You've got to make a decision. So every subject matter expert comes prepared with at least one high priority conversation that they feel. And if you're giving guidance to your subject matter expert and they're saying, like, what? The guidance you give them is this. When we think in terms of the highest priority conversation, it's almost always some conversation about something the client could be doing that they're not currently doing or not currently doing enough in order to accelerate the results that they've said that they want. So they have goals that they've shared with you and your team. What could they do to accelerate? Another important conversation could be a conversation about preventing a problem. So if you're being very proactive and you've got your financial planner looking way ahead, years ahead, what is it that the client could be doing now to prevent what your crack team is determined is a potential problem down the road? A high priority conversation could be a conversation about preventing a problem that you're seeing unfold in the future. And then finally, a high priority conversation often is a crucial conversation confronting an obstacle that's in the way of the client. Oftentimes it is a behavioral issue for the client. So maybe they're spending too much money, or maybe they something you have identified or your team is proposing is a crucial conversation that is going to be focused on addressing and confronting an obstacle. So that is a lot of detail going through just what is simply a 20-minute three-point agenda where every subject matter expert contributes. You're prioritizing the recommendations and action items, and you don't leave the meeting until you've finalized the client agenda, which is to identify the highest priority conversations. So make sure these three things get done during the dry run prep meeting. And my advice to you as a trusted advisor, after the dry run prep meeting, be sure to block your calendar. Block time over the next week. We call this the quiet time, in order to thoughtfully prepare to deliver an extraordinary client meeting experience. By having all this work and effort done a week to 10 days in advance, you'll be able to do what almost no financial advisors do, and that is to actually prepare for a client meeting and give it some thought, given the fact that you've got a week to do it. And with that, we wish you all the best in implementing. Good luck with your dry run prep meeting, and good luck in becoming indispensable to your clients. I'm Mark Little, and until next month, we wish you all the best.